This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, April 23rd, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums. The CD release party for Cletus Got Shot will be this Friday at the UARC Bowl on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. Performers also include Adam Lee and the Dead Horse Sound Company and Threepenny Acre. Tickets will be available at the door beginning at 6 p.m. with the show at 7. More information is available on the web at uarcbowl.com. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, the fallout from yesterday's New York Times 8,000-word front-page investigation into Walmart's operations in Mexico. The article examines allegations of widespread bribes to Mexican officials to help speed up construction of stores in that country. And we'll have a preview of tomorrow night's Science Cafe discussion about the American diet and more. First, these items of interest. Arkansas's unemployment rate is at a nearly three-year low. Kimberly Friedman with the State Department of Workforce Services says the latest monthly figures represent the eighth consecutive month in which the number of Arkansas jobs grew.
Arkansas' seasonally adjusted unemployment rate declined 0.2 percentage point from 7.6% in February to 7.4% in March. So Arkansas' rate decreased 0.2 in March at 7.4%, and comparing that to what it was a year ago at 8%, the rate in March this year is a lot lower than it was a year ago.
Nationally, the unemployment rate in March dropped 0.1 percentage point to 8.2%. Beginning today, new patrons of the Bentonville Library will need to show proof of residency with a utility bill or notice to obtain a library card. Library officials say the practice is standard at many libraries in the country and will allow the library to maintain more accurate records and save postage costs. In the past, the library has mailed welcome letters to new residents. Another procedural change is scheduled for next month that will allow the Bentonville Library to use collection agencies to help retrieve articles kept for 60 days past the due date. Some 7,000 patient names and medical information were accidentally released to a medical billing company by a doctor at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences. Leslie Taylor with the UAMS Office of Communication says patient names and information about their illnesses were inadvertently released. She says the hospital is notifying patients whose information might have been included in the breach.
Whenever something like this occurs, even if it's just one person who saw this information, which is more than likely what happened in this instance, it's still a breach of patient information. And we are required to notify patients. We've sent letters to all affected patients who would have been interventional radiology patients seen at UAMS between 2009 and 2011.
Leslie Taylor says no social security numbers or financial information was released. The doctor who released the information has been placed on administrative leave. Siloam Springs is on a new list of the 20 best small towns in America. The Smithsonian Magazine's new issue places the Benton County town at number 14 on the list, citing the town's setting in the Ozark Hills and revived downtown. Great Barrington, Massachusetts was number one on that list. Busy weekend for sports in the area. The University of Arkansas gymnastics team ends the year as the sixth-ranked team in the country. The Razorbacks advance to this weekend's NCAA championship final round in Duluth, Georgia. The Razorback women's golf team finished second in the SEC tournament this weekend at the Blessings Golf Course in Johnson, while the men's team took a fifth-place finish in the SEC tournament in Georgia. And the Razorback baseball team defeated Mississippi yesterday 11-3 to salvage one win in the three-game series at Oxford. Arkansas is now third in the SEC West, three games behind LSU. Razorbacks will next host Oral Roberts University tomorrow night in Fayetteville at 6:35. Then will travel to Florida this weekend for a three-game series against the nationally fifth-ranked Gators. This is Ozarks at Large. This weekend, the New York Times published an 8,000-word investigative report alleging Walmart, the world's largest retailer, conducted a massive bribery campaign in a quest to expand retail operations in Mexico. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, the article also traces efforts to suppress an internal company investigation into the scandal all the way to the headquarters in Bentonville.
The ambitious New York Times report alleges that top executives and lawyers operating as Walmart de Mexico paid as much as $24 million in bribes to obtain construction permits, sourcing hundreds of internal company documents, including interviews with a former senior Walmart de Mexico executive. The report painted a complex and secret campaign to build dominance in the Mexican retail marketplace. Initially, Walmart executives at headquarters in Bentonville sent an investigative team to Mexico City, where, the Times report says, evidence of bribery and efforts to conceal it from the Bentonville executives were found. The bribes involved cash payments to government officials, mayors, city council members, urban planners, and permit bureaucrats to ensure zoning approvals, reduced environmental impact fees, and local support. But rather than expanding its investigation, Walmart leaders, including then Walmart's chief executive Lee Scott, worked to subdue it, the report says. Quoting the article, neither American nor Mexican law enforcement officials were notified. None of Walmart de Mexico's leaders were disciplined. Indeed, its chief executive, Eduardo Castro Wright, identified by the former executive as the driving force behind years of bribery, was promoted to vice chairman of Walmart in 2008. Until this article, the allegations in Walmart's investigation had never been publicly disclosed. End quote. The investigation was then handed over to General Counsel of Walmart de Mexico, a remarkable choice, the Times report said, since the same General Counsel was alleged to have authorized bribes, it said. That lawyer went on to exonerate all those involved in the bribery campaign. The New York Times presented its findings to Walmart several weeks ago. Neither Castro Wright or Lee Scott would comment, it said. But in response to the article published over the weekend, the company quickly issued a press release, beginning with Walmart being committed to compliance with the U.S. Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, or FCPA. The company also posted a video statement by spokesman David Tovar.
Many of the alleged activities in the New York Times article are more than 6 years old. If these allegations are true, it is not a reflection of who we are or what we stand for. We are deeply concerned by these allegations and are working aggressively to determine what happened. In the fall of last year, the company, through the Audit Committee of the Board of Directors, began an extensive investigation related to compliance with the FCPA. We have met voluntarily with the U.S. Department of Justice and the Securities and Exchange Commission to self-disclose the ongoing investigation on this matter. We also filed a 10-Q in December to inform our shareholders of the investigation.
Tovar went on to say the company has taken a number of actions in Mexico to establish stronger FCPA compliance.
The investigation is ongoing, and we don't have a full explanation of what happened. It would be inappropriate for us to comment further on the specific allegations until we have finished the investigation. We are working hard to understand what occurred in Bentonville more than 6 years ago and are committed to conducting a complete investigation before forming conclusions. We don't want to speculate or weave stories from incomplete inquiries and limited recollections, as others might do. Unfortunately, we realize that, at this point, there are some unanswered questions. We wish we could say more, but we will not jeopardize the integrity of the investigation. We are confident we are conducting a comprehensive investigation, and if violations of our policies occurred here, we will take appropriate action.
Tovar said that in the spring of 2011, the company initiated a worldwide review of its anti-corruption program.
In a large global enterprise such as Walmart, sometimes issues arise despite our best efforts and intentions. When they do, we take them seriously and act as quickly as possible to understand what happened. We take action and work to implement changes so the issue doesn't happen again. That's what we're doing today. Walmart is committed to doing the right thing, and we are working hard every day to become an even better company.
In recent years, Walmart's Mexico and Central American operations have become the company's poster child for global retail growth. As of January this year, Walmart operates more than 2,000 supercenters, Sam Clubs, bodegas, which are neighborhood markets, restaurants, and pharmacies across the region. In December, Walmart informed the U.S. Justice Department it had launched an internal investigation into its overseas operations, including China, Mexico, and Japan, regarding permitting, licensing, and inspections, which is ongoing. Walmart operates 9,600 retail units in over 28 countries, employing 2.1 million associates. In fiscal year ending January 2011, net sales Walmart operates 9,600 retail units in over 28 countries, employing 2.1 million associates. In fiscal year ending January 2011, net sales increased by 3.4% to $419 billion. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Over the past few years, more than 100 cities across the country have adopted a concept called Science Cafe. That's where scientists and researchers meet the public to discuss a particular scientific subject. The University of Arkansas STEM Center for Mathematics and Science Education has, for the last year, held a handful of science cafes in Fayetteville. Past topics of discussion have included water quality, weather, and earthquakes. The next science cafe, tomorrow night at Powerhouse Seafood and Grill in Fayetteville, will have an appropriate concept for something with cafe in the title. The topic of discussion, the American diet. The three participants in tomorrow's Science Cafe recently came to KUAF. That conversation began with the definition of what is the American diet. Cindy Moore, a registered dietitian and clinical assistant professor in the Department of Foods, Human Nutrition, and Hospitality at the University of Arkansas, says there is the prescribed or ideal American diet.
Eat the right amount of calories for you and be physically active your way. And then there are subheadings, for example, under Build a Healthy Plate, make half your plate fruits and vegetables.
Those guidelines are outlined in something called My Plate, endorsed by First Lady Michelle Obama last year. But it isn't really the American diet, not what we eat. As Navam Hidiorici, a professor in the Department of Food Science at the U of A, points out, what we really eat as a nation is far different.
It is characterized by high intakes of red meat, sugary desserts, high-fat foods, and refined grains. It contains high-fat dairy products, high-sugar drinks, as you know, like Coke, eggs, and higher intakes of processed meat.
As has been widely documented, the gap between the suggested and real American diets is responsible for ever-increasing cases of heart disease, obesity, and diabetes. The third participant in tomorrow night's Science Cafe, Susan Patton, a clinical instructor in the Eleanor Mann School of Nursing at the U of A, says poor diet is not always just a case of somebody picking the wrong foods. She says there is a high connection between obesity and food insecurity. And Arkansas has the third highest rate of food insecurity in the country. Susan Patton says there are a number of reasons for food insecurity in the state, including a lack of access to affordable, nutritious foods for all.
Low-income neighborhoods as a whole frequently lack full-service grocery stores and have more or farmers markets and have more convenience stores. And there was a large study done about neighborhood disparities and the quality of food, and they found that residents who have better access to supermarkets and limited access to convenience stores actually eat healthier and have reduced risk for obesity.
Food insecurity isn't the only cause for the rise in obesity, heart disease, and other ailments related to poor diet. All three of tomorrow night's panelists think a higher priority needs to be placed on education about nutrition for adults and children. Cindy Moore says she'd like to see a nutritional curriculum in schools, but also more education for adults as well. She says the level of information has to be accessible. For example, it's easier for us to remember that eating fish is a good way to get valuable omega-3 fatty acids than actually trying to maintain a proper count at home on how much omega-3 has been consumed in a given week.
We must keep the message as simple as possible, or else people are not going to remember. Something that locally Walmart has done to try to help is their new labeling, the Great For You labeling. So, you know, when we've got retailers trying to partner with us, providing that type of consumer assistance on the labels, that certainly makes a difference, I think. I haven't talked with anyone yet about what they think about that label. I've read some criticisms about it just, you know, being so detailed. And if people simply read the nutrition facts label and the ingredient list, they wouldn't need the Great For You label.
Cindy Moore also credits the Fayetteville School District for its free classes designed to help parents prepare tasty nutritional meals at home. And she says education should include the notion that nutrition should come from, first and foremost, food.
It's important that people get those from food, if at all possible, and not take supplements. Susan, you can speak to this as a nurse, that when we start having individuals take individual supplements and pills for different things, say fish oil caplet every day, that needs to be done under a doctor's supervision. If we have people that are out there taking vitamin E, you know, fish oil supplements, if they're in a car accident, they're gonna hemorrhage and not survive. So it's really critical that people don't panic and have a medicine chest full of individual supplements that we try for the most part to get these nutrients from foods. But the what Navam's saying about having fish, that's excellent, and that makes it simple. The dietary guidelines say in under the category Build a Healthy Plate that we should encourage 2 servings of fish a week. And so that is some of what we've got in myplate.gov and the Dietary Guidelines for Americans 2010 to simplify those messages for the consumer, for the general public.
Susan Patton, another participant in tomorrow night's Science Cafe, says a pretty simple concept taking root in many Arkansas schools will also go a long way toward better nutritional education.
Gardens. And there is a big movement in the schools across the state to have gardens in the school. I also would like to see gardens in communities. It's a great way for people to get out, get to know each other, get active, and plant gardens.
She says at least a couple of statewide organizations, the Arkansas Coalition for Obesity Prevention and Arkansas Hunger Relief, are working on establishing more gardens in communities. And as Navam Hitarichi, a professor in the Department of Food Sciences at the U of A, reminds, diet is an important, but not solitary, ingredient in preventing many health problems.
In addition to eating healthy foods, which we have been discussing, exercise is very important. That has to go hand in hand. It's just not, the food by itself is not going to help them in any way. So that has to be part of it.
The Science Cafe conversation about diet, exercise, nutrition, education, and more will be tomorrow night from 6:30 until 8 at Powerhouse Seafood and Grill in Fayetteville. There will be an approximately 30-minute presentation from the panelists, followed by an opportunity for those attending to join in the discussion. This is Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. These are the first 15 words of the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Since the ratification of those words in the 18th century, they've been studied, debated, and examined. Jack Rakove has spent much time considering the words. He's working on a book about them and how they came to be. He is the William Robertson Co-Professor of History and American Studies and Professor of Political Science and Law at Stanford University. He's the author of 6 books, including Original Meanings, Politics, and Ideas in the Making of the Constitution. That won the 1997 Pulitzer Prize in History. He's on the University of Arkansas campus to deliver the spring Hartman Hotz Lecture in Law and Liberal Arts, and he's with me inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. Welcome.
Really happy to be here.
The title of the lecture is Beyond Belief, the Radical Significance of the Free Exercise of Religion. Radical is a strong word.
It is a strong word. I don't mean it in the kind of conventional political sense, but I do mean it to suggest that there was something truly fundamental about recognizing broadly, not just the right to believe, but the right to exercise religion freely.
For governments in the Western world up to the 17th century, that was not something that had been
Not entirely. I mean, by the late 18th century, by the time when the First Amendment was written, there's a fairly broad recognition, particularly within the Anglo-American world, of the right to freedom of conscience, you know, the idea of toleration, meaning that most groups would be accepted as peaceful members of society as long as they weren't too public or too obnoxious. But there's a big difference, at least there's a significant difference between toleration, which implies that the state is giving a privilege that it can revoke, and the recognition that the free exercise of religion is a constitutional or a fundamental or a natural right. It doesn't depend upon a government grant. It's something we inherently possess. So, yeah, there is a significant development from, let's say, when John Locke wrote his letter concerning toleration at the end of the 17th century to the point where the First Amendment gets ratified in 1791, almost exactly a century later.
In 1791, this was referring to federal law.
Yes.
States could still have an official religion?
Right, and several states did. And in fact, we have a rather complicated topography or map of what the state of established or quasi-disestablished religion would look like in the original states. So, you know, New England, Connecticut, and Massachusetts retained established churches into the early 19th century. Elsewhere, you'd find a number of states practicing what we now sometimes call non-preferential forms of establishment, meaning a kind of general support for religion, at least for Protestant Christianity, without discriminating in any particular way between different denominations or different sects. I think you'd also find, though, that there's a strong movement at the state level away from even non-preferential disestablishment, a kind of growing confidence that, you know, congregations, denominations really should be self-sustaining, voluntary organizations, that they don't really need the support of the state. And in fact, that's essentially what 19th century America produced, a society of freely thriving, practicing, and competing religious denominations.
Almost any American who engages in public discourse or even private discourse about freedom of religion will, at the very least, be able to paraphrase these 15 words. It seems like something that is, if not completely agreed upon what it means, taken for granted. There was a lot of work, though, in before this was written to come to these words.
I think well, a lot of work. Work is a strong term, but there are a lot of developments that take place. I think, particularly in the decades, let's say the three to four decades preceding the American Revolution, preceding 1776, it's a really interesting argument that in multiple ways, not with any one theory, you know, beating the drum for disestablishment, and not that everybody's waking up in the morning and reading Locke, much less Spinoza, you know, on issues of religious disestablishment, but that Americans were moving towards a broadly tolerationist society where they did broadly assume that the rights of private judgment, the rights of you or I or every individual, male and female, to decide what he or she thought about the proper mode of salvation, that was being broadly accepted. there are people opposed to it and people accept it reluctantly, and a number of members of the clergy are not entirely happy to accept the implications that follow. You know, the idea that, let's say you have a church in a community which is essentially functioning like a parish church, mm-hmm. One church for the whole community, or maybe in some towns you have two or three, but the idea that people could just come in and freely set up shop. Before the Revolution, that still would have been a somewhat controversial position, but in the larger American towns, you know, places like Philadelphia, Boston, New York, there's no effective limitation on the establishment of churches. You know, in smaller towns, maybe it raises greater sensibilities. So I think you make a good argument that America is already moving beyond tolerationism, you know, beyond the idea that the state should grant the privilege, to a more open acceptance of the idea that this is essentially a right that ordinary people can choose to exercise as they want.
The idea is to give – I mean, it's a very private individual concept.
Yes.
That you, me, yeah. Everyone has yeah. Our own choice to make.
And that's exactly what I want to stress by the radical part. So, I mean, the significance here is that I think of all the rights we possess, you know, think of the rights protected in, you know, the first eight articles of the Bill of Rights, or, you know, throw the 14th Amendment in as well. But, you know, that essentially what I want to argue is that of all the rights we possess, the one that actually places the greatest degree of autonomy on your right or my right to do what we want independent of public supervision is really the exercise of freedom of conscience, which I think in some ways precedes the exercise of free speech politically. I mean, there's a kind of complicated history between them. I think it becomes easier to argue about God than it does to argue about the king. Hmm. Although what you say about the king eventually follows what you could say about God in certain ways. Yeah, so the radical part is to say that this is the most individualistic, the most liberal. I don't mean that in the blue state, red state sense. But
not
the
capital
idea,
L.
But the
yeah.
idea of individual rights. I think the most subjective, meaning the one that places the greatest emphasis on our private consciousness. If you think about most other rights, they don't create zones of exemption from mm-hmm. the authority of the state. You can always be arrested. You can always be tried. Your property can always be searched. Your property can be, you know, taken for public use under eminent domain. What most other rights suggest is not that we have an absolute protection against the authority of the state, but that when the state acts towards us, it has to do so in conformity with some fixed standards which will respect fundamental values. But the state can still act. Mm-hmm. It just has to conform to those norms. Religion is different. You know, it says here's an area of behavior that all societies previously would have thought should be under public supervision because, after all, it's quite dangerous to allow people to wander around spouting their religious beliefs, you know, for lots of reasons that European history confirms. So the idea of a broad acceptance of freedom of conscience essentially says that the state is going to pull out of this area. Now, that still is open if you commit overt acts, right? I mean, if there's outward behavior. In fact, there are lots of forms of behavior which might become problematic. So you have to deal here with what I think was actually a fundamentally Protestant, you know, Christian Protestant notion of religiosity, one that really places the greatest emphasis on what you believe in your heart of hearts, you know, in your soul, in your convictions about whatever you want to argue about, you know, whether it's transubstantiation or salvation or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But still, it does recognize a broad zone of privacy in that sense.
Well, the phrase, no law.
No law, right.
Okay.
Right, yeah.
Case closed?
Depends.
It says no law.
Yeah, it depends on who you talk to. Well, that was Justice Black's position, Hugo Black's position, you know, the famous Supreme Court justice from Alabama who was a, you know, strong New Dealer and, you know, very much of a Southern progressive. No law means no law. That's pretty hard to maintain. So although, you know, it's not a bad formula. I mean, in principle, actually, I'd rather happen to like it. But inevitably, cases arise, you know, situations occur that you can't cover by a blanket constitutional formula. So legislatures in one way or another are impelled to act. And, that's when you get into a lot of legal slicing and dicing, you know, to see which side of the, you know, which side of the coin you come down on, legislative regulation or, you know, the exemptions, accorded to private individuals. But, yeah, there is a broad reading that says no law means no law, so just get out of the business, lock, stock, and barrel.
I guess that is, though, a sort of naive approach to take.
Well, in some ways naive. On the other hand, I mean, I happen to think that, the two guys I personally like most, being Jefferson and Madison, would be pretty close to that position. I mean, they certainly felt that no law means there should be no public funding going to actively support religion. But, you know, take a modern case. Let's say you have some altruistic activity, something meant to, be part of our general network of social welfare, and churches want to join in that activity. Should they be excluded because they're churches? You know, well, arguably not. You worry about whether or not there's something fungible about the funds and whether or not that kind of support will go towards, making it easier for them to propagate their religious beliefs. Maybe that raises an Establishment Clause issue. That's the kind of things that, you know, lawyers argue about and judges ultimately have to decide.
You don't have to go any further than a cable news network or perhaps a Letters to the Editor page to find interpretations of what the Founding Fathers meant for this country to be when it comes to religion.
Right.
Does anybody get it right? Does anybody know? I mean,
well, you know, if you ask a question like that, it really has to do with how we read history. You know, when historians read history, and I think particularly today, we understand that there's a multiplicity of voices out there. You know, they had debates just the way we did, and religion was one thing they debated pretty actively, and especially started debating more actively in the 1790s in reaction to the French Revolution, and then on into the 19th century in the aftermath of the Great Awakening. So I think the first thing that what I call civilians, you know, meaning lay readers, mm-hmm. are likely, if not to get wrong, to get in a kind of partial, biased way, is that I think Americans want to homogenize their image of the framers. You know, it's like they were one generation at one moment with one mind. It wasn't like that. You know, they had, sharp and, sometimes bitter arguments, and there's a range of positions. I mean, I like Madison and Jefferson. They're the leading edge of American thinking. If they're the leading edge, they're not the most representative figures. So that's one problem. I think a second problem you get is I think there's a lot of cherry picking that goes on, you know, meaning that, it's just as lawyers say, get me a cite, you know, give me a historical quotation that will support my position. I think a lot of what passes for, you know, a kind of scholarship, I think particularly on the right, is a form of cherry picking, you know, where everything would suggest that, deep religiosity. You know, if you look at what's written about Washington or, you know, I think Washington in particular, also Jefferson, Madison was extremely private about his religious convictions. I've studied Madison for 40 years. I wouldn't want to say, I really couldn't say what the state of his religious thinking was. Mm-hmm. By that time. So I think there are two big problems, you know, the desire to homogenize, which loses the actual diversity on the one hand, and then the, you know, the cherry picking problem, which is, you know, you're in this for political arguments. So you look, you know, you look, well, get me that site. Look for the quotations that are most conducive to my position.
And we as individuals tend to want verification rather than education at times.
You know, to be a historian, being a historian is a lot of fun because you get to play around with the diversity of the sources. But people want to make history work for them, have other objectives.
Jack Raycove is the William Robertson Coe Professor of History and American Studies and Professor of Political Science and Law at Stanford University. He's the author of 6 books, including Original Meanings, Politics and Ideas in the Making of the Constitution, which won the 1997 Pulitzer Prize in History. Last week, he delivered the Spring Hartman-Hotz Lecture in Law and Liberal Arts on the University of Arkansas campus.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
People walk up. And they ask me, they say, Spoon, what is the blues? Well, I've had them for a long, long time. Started in a little old town down in Gurdon, Arkansas.
Jimmy Witherspoon was born August 8, 1923, in Gurdon, Arkansas, to Leonard and Eva Witherspoon's religious family. His mother was against secular music. It wasn't until Witherspoon joined the Merchant Marine and sat in with jazz pianist Teddy Weatherford and his orchestra in Calcutta that Witherspoon said he started singing the blues. In fact, it may have been the Clark County native's very lack of background in secular music that allowed him to record albums over his career that covered blues, ballads, rock, and especially jazz.
Price is getting steeper. Found myself a woman, but I just couldn't keep her. Time's getting tougher than tough. Things getting rougher than rough. When I make a lot of money, I just keep spending the stuff.
After leaving the Merchant Marine, Witherspoon joined Jumpin' J. McShann's band in the mid-1940s. He replaced vocalist Walter Brown, and the group recorded for several labels. In 1949, the group cut a song originally recorded by blues woman Bessie Smith a few months before Witherspoon was even born in 1923. It became Spoon's signature song, Ain't Nobody's Business.
One day, we've got ham and bacon. Next day, ain't nothing shaken. Ain't nobody's business if we do. And I started singing the blues. My mother told me, son, you shouldn't sing those old dirty songs. You're going to hell. You see, my mother's a very religious woman. And I was going to hell. Until I made Ain't Nobody's Business. And I sold 1 million copies. Then Jimmy Witherspoon was our baby.
Although Witherspoon never again matched the success of Ain't Nobody's Business, he stayed solo. The 1950s and 60s saw Spoon on tour, in film and in TV appearances, and recording in a variety of styles. The Clark County native's October 2, 1959 appearance at the Monterey Jazz Festival was considered a comeback, and it included an all-star band, including Father Hines, Coleman Hawkins, and Woody Herman.
I don't want a thing, but that big fine girl of mine.
In 1974, Witherspoon appeared as the title character in the blaxploitation film The Black Godfather. It was his first and largest role in a very sporadic acting career. He continued recording with rockers like Eric Burdon and Members of War, and solo blues rock LPs with sidemen like Joe Walsh, Groove Holmes, Earl Hooker, and Charles Brown.
I want to tell all you fellas a secret, and please keep it to yourself.
By the 1980s, when he contracted throat cancer, The Gurdon native had long since achieved elder statesman status. He won the NAACP Image Award in 1975, was a 1977 Ebony Magazine Hall of Fame inductee, and ironically was Downbeat Magazine's new star male vocalist in 1961 and 1968.
Ooh, sorry now. Sorry now.
In June 1996, Witherspoon was awarded the Art Porter Lifetime Achievement Award, given by the Arkansas Jazz Heritage Foundation. He was to be the guest of honor at the awards ceremony. Spoon didn't show, and it was later revealed he had cashed in his plane ticket, and no one from the foundation had heard from him. The following fall, on September 18, 1997, Jimmy Witherspoon died in Los Angeles, California. Here in its entirety is Jimmy Witherspoon's 1958 version of Ain't Nobody's Business.
One day, we've got ham and bacon. Next day, ain't nothing shaking. Ain't nobody's business if we do. Give me and my baby fuss and fight, and the next minute we are right. Ain't nobody's business if we do. Baby, oh, baby, you know our love is true. And it ain't nobody's business what we do. But I'm 3 times 7. That makes 21. Ain't nobody's business what I do. Well, if I stay out all night, spend my money, that's all right. Ain't nobody's business what I do. Ain't nobody's business what I do.
From Gurdon, Arkansas, Jimmy Witherspoon's 1958 version of Ain't Nobody's Business. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer of Arkansongs is Keith Merks. For more information or to subscribe to the podcast, visit arkansongs.org.
This is Ozarks at Large for the 23rd day of April 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums. The Fort Smith Chorale will perform its 31st annual spring concert, Light Eternal, Thursday at 7:30 p.m. This concert will be held at the First Baptist Church in Fort Smith and will highlight John Roeder's Requiem, plus folk songs from Germany, Ireland, and the Americas. Tickets will be available at the door. Details are available on the web at fortsmithchorale.com. Some Fayetteville residents have already noticed the artwork covering two storm drains in the city, one where the Frisco Trail intersects with West Avenue and another where the trail intersects with Maple Street. Over the next few weeks, similar artwork will also pop up in Springdale, Rogers, and Bentonville. Ozarks at Large's Ithi Agnihotri Madolker became curious, and she decided to find out the motive behind painting these storm drain inlets.
It's amazing. I mean, most people have to get their art in galleries and that kind of stuff, but nope. This is right here in the open, so everyone gets to see it.
I would say thousands of people have seen it so far, just today.
Probably, yeah, I would agree.
It's a lot of people on this trail.
I thought you were totally BSing me when you told me that it was that amount of people.
Leah Safian has just completed her masterpiece,
on the sidewalk where Frisco Trail intersects with Maple Street in Fayetteville.
Basically, it is a pair of green hands cupping a pool of water, and the water is spilling out of the hands at the bottom into the storm drain, and out of the top a purple coneflower is coming out, and then the zebra swallowtail is coming down onto the flower.
Safian, who recently moved to Fayetteville from Dallas, is an environmental educator for Washington County through Energy Corps. Her sidewalk artwork is part of the Northwest Arkansas Upstream Art Project, an effort launched by the University of Arkansas Cooperative Extension Service in partnership with Northwest Arkansas Stormwater Education Program. Jane Maganot is a program associate with the U of A Cooperative Extension Service and the project's coordinator.
Non-point source pollution is the number one pollutant source in the United States, and that is when stormwater that's carried over our streets and sidewalk surfaces is ran into storm drains, and it carries with that pollutants such as chemicals, oils, greases, fertilizers, grass clippings, and a big one's pet waste, excess nutrients and bacteria from pet waste into our storm drains. And all of that goes untreated into our waterways, so our creeks, our streams, our lakes, and eventually into the ocean. Many people look at storm drains and they think that actually gets treated before going into our waterways, and that's not true.
Maganot says the idea to create artwork around storm drains was borrowed from Springfield, Missouri.
Todd Wagner and Jennifer Frey from Springfield, Missouri, they did a similar project with the James River Basin Partnership, and the city of Springfield partnered, and they did it in Springfield. They did a few drains in a downtown area, and they came and presented the project to us, and we thought this would be a great fit for our regional program that incorporates all of Northwest Arkansas.
The project is a collaborative effort between various regional and private agencies, including the cities of Fayetteville, Springdale, Rogers, and Bentonville, Walton Arts Center, and the University of Arkansas Division of Agriculture Research and Extension. Maganot says the planning process for the project began in January, and the call for artwork submission was announced toward the beginning of February.
We did a juried selection, so it was a group of people from the University of Arkansas's Department of Fine Art actually came in and helped us with the jurying process, some grad students there, as well as the cities, and we chose the art that we felt was the best that represented the message of the art, that it needed to have that environmental impact, and then also is that it actually was aesthetically pleasing. And then the mayors of each city actually had to sign off okay on each art, so they had the final say-so.
Aside from Leah Safian, designs from four other local artists, namely Randall Rust, Renee Reed, Bill Ward, and Martin Newman, were selected to be painted on 8 storm drains in Northwest Arkansas. The artists will be using acrylic non-toxic water-based paint that is supposed to last between 3 to 5 years.
But our real concern is to make sure in the promoting of storm drain awareness and water pollution, it actually has to do with the cleanup of that paint. So as soon as it starts to chip, we actually have to go through and have it power sprayed off. And we'll have there's actually these type of industrial vacuum cleaners that suck the paint up off the ground so it doesn't go into the storm drains.
Oh, wow.
So as soon as we have to kind of keep an eye on it, and as soon as it starts to chip, the whole paint gets removed. And as we increase storm drains, we hope that the art becomes really a visual impact on the city as the drains start to multiply.
Hopefully I don't get hit by a car right here at the end. That would suck.
Artist Leah Safian is also responsible for painting the storm drain across the street. The other design features a cave salamander. Safian says her designs are inspired by Arkansas's native flora and fauna.
I go to Devil's Den frequently, and I was there with my dog the day that I decided to do the second drawing, because this is the second design I did. And I saw a bunch of zebra swallowtails pooling by the river, and so I thought I'd really like to include one in my picture that I do for the stormwater education. And so I just really wanted to incorporate something that showed, you know, the beauty of this area in particular.
Safian says it took her approximately 12 hours to make the artwork.
I was pretty exhausted yesterday. I'm a little sore today, but it's worth it.
So what has been the hardest part about painting on a sidewalk?
Honestly, the debris blowing on here has been the hardest part. Because, I mean, you paint something and then all this stuff gets stuck to it. And you just want to pick it off, but it's best if you just leave it alone, I found. So that's definitely been the trial and error kind of side of it.
The piece now is almost complete.
All right, now I'm going to put my signature on and walk away.
I asked Jane Maginot about what she wants people to take away from the sidewalk storm drain artwork.
First of all, I want them to have the impact. When they're walking down the street, you normally don't stop and look at that storm drain and think, oh man, there's a storm drain. I bet I could create, you know, some water quality problem by putting something down that. It's not something that comes about. They really aren't noticed. So we just hope someone to actually take a look at that storm drain, be aware that it's actually there, and then actually start to think, well, what happens to that water when it goes down that storm drain, and question where the water goes. And by questioning, they actually might find out that what impact that water has.
The Northwest Arkansas Upstream Art Project is being organized by the University of Arkansas Cooperative Extension Service and involves creating 8 storm drain artworks in 4 cities in the region. To learn more, visit nwaupstreamart.wetpaint.com. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Iti Agnihotri Matholkar.
And it's time now for a question. Today's winner will receive 2 tickets to any area Malco movie theater and 2 vouchers that can be exchanged for tickets for any home Northwest Arkansas Naturals baseball game this season. The Naturals begin an 8-game homestand at Arvest Ballpark in Springdale tonight. They'll be hosting Springfield. The Travelers from North Little Rock will be in town later this week. So, here is the question for today. It was on this date in 1616 that many scholars believe William Shakespeare died. So we'll have a Shakespearean question for you. In what play of Shakespeare's was the word assassination first used in a literary work? What Shakespeare play made the literary debut of the word assassination? If you have a guess, you can call us at 800-522-5823. That's 1-800-522-5823. KUAF. All correct answers go in the ceramic cow. 1 lucky winner will be picked for the tickets. Good luck.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 23rd of April, 2012. It's the birthday of Roy Orbison, born in Vernon, Texas, in 1936. The birthday of Vladimir Nabokov, born in St. Petersburg, Russia, 1899. His family fled the Bolshevik Revolution, settled in England, then in Berlin, where he fled the Nazis in 1936, settled in the United States. He taught college through the 40s and 50s until 1961, and the success of his novel Lolita enabled him to retire to Switzerland and write full-time until he died in 1977. And today is the day we celebrate the birthday of William Shakespeare. Stratford-upon-Avon, England, 1564. He was baptized on the 26th of April, so we assume his birthday is right around today. His father, a successful glover and farmer, family comfortable. Shakespeare went to school at the local school, studied Latin, classic literature, history at the age of 18, applied for a marriage license with Anne Hathaway, who was 26. The marriage was rushed. 6 months later, Anne gave birth to a daughter named Susanna. 2 years later, she had twins, Judith and Hamnet. Nobody knows when or why Shakespeare left for London. May have been in trouble for poaching deer, may have been running away from an unhappy marriage. Still others think he was just ambitious. By 1592, we find his name in print, praised by another playwright. 2 years later, he was writing his plays for the Lord Chamberlain's Men, a troupe owned by a group of actors, including Shakespeare. Most of his plays were performed at the Globe Theatre, which we know had 20 sides, a diameter of about 100 feet. It could seat about 3,000 people. It had an open section right in front of the stage, no seats, no roof, and the groundling stood there. They paid very little for a ticket. They were free to drink and eat and shout at the actors and do whatever they wanted to do. Shakespeare acted in many of the plays himself. We don't know what roles he played. He is said to have played the ghost in Hamlet. In all, he wrote 38 plays and the famous sonnets, died in 1616 at the age of 52. George Bernard Shaw was not an admirer. He thought Shakespeare's philosophy was empty, incoherent, that he was a superficial, rather ignorant writer. Tolstoy thought Shakespeare was a big disappointment, rather tedious. Voltaire said Shakespeare was a savage with some imagination, but popular only in England. So if you dislike Shakespeare, you are in excellent company. Here's a sonnet for Shakespeare's birthday. Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love, which alters when it alteration finds, or bends with the remover to remove. Oh, no, it is an ever-fixed mark that looks on tempests and is never shaken. It is the star to every wandering bark, whose worth's unknown, although his height be taken. Love's not time's fool, though rosy lips and cheeks within his bending sickle's compass come. Love alters not with his brief hours and weeks, but bears it out even to the edge of doom. If this be error, and upon me proved, I never writ, nor no man ever loved. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by Constant Contact, now offering social campaigns, a new tool designed to help small businesses turn fans into customers. Learn more at constantcontact.com. And by reputation.com, offering patented protection for the online reputations of professionals and businesses, now including reputation assessments. Learn more at reputation.com. Produced by Kathy Roach, written by Betsy Alistair. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
And as Garrison Keillor just mentioned, many people put this as the birth date of William Shakespeare. Many people also say April 23rd, 1616 was the day Shakespeare died. So we had a Shakespearean trivia question. Winner today receives two tickets to any Malco area movie theater and two vouchers that we will send you that then can be exchanged depending on availability for any home game for the Northwest Arkansas Naturals. The Nats open up an eight-game homestand at Arvest Ballpark in Springdale tonight. The question was, in what literary work did Shakespeare apparently first use the word assassination? And the answer is Macbeth. That is, for many people, the first actual literary use of the word assassination was in the play Macbeth. All correct answers to today's question are going in the ceramic cow. I'll pull out a lucky name here in a few minutes and then give you a call if you're today's winner. And the University of Arkansas Theater presents Cabaret with performances through April 29th at the University Theater Fine Arts Center in Fayetteville. This classic musical examines what it means to be free and the intricacies of love and war. Tickets and more information are available at 575-3946. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers. Today we'll extend the listening area just a bit south to include Hamlet, Arkansas, just south of Conway. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening. Another brand new edition of Ozarks tomorrow at noon on KUAF.
Brush up your Shakespeare. Start quoting him now. Brush up your Shakespeare and know women you'll...